Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Long Story Short, the podcast about storytelling and connection, where we interview marketers and entrepreneurs to hear the stories they tell about their brands. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Sophia. This is a podcast by humans for humans who also happen to be marketers. On this week's show, our guest is Jeffrey Mack.
Jeff is the Senior Director of Demand Generation at ISEMS, a global leader in recruiting technology. At ISEMS, he is responsible for leading the company's strategic growth campaigns across both prospect and customer segments. Prior to ISEMS, Jeff led account-based marketing efforts for LinkedIn Talent Solutions and helped grow their LEAD program, an invitation-only customer community for senior talent leaders across the world. Prior to LinkedIn, Jeff held leadership roles at companies like Glia, Softcard, which is now Google Pay, HSBC, and Crestron Electronics. When he's not working, Jeff can be found pretending to be Aladdin or a Jedi Knight with his three kids and his wife. You can connect with Jeff on Twitter at Jeffrey Mack.
So we've heard of T-shaped marketers, but have you ever met someone who's a W? In this week's episode, we gain insight into Jeff's various areas of expertise, ranging from how to stand out in this digital world to Jeff's empathetic leadership approach.
It was great to get Jeff's take on the present and future of team and talent. And so without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Jeffrey Mack.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you so much for being on this week's episode of Long Story Short.
Thank you for having me. I'm actually really excited. I love to chit chat, and I feel like this is a great opportunity to do so. And we have so much to speak about, I'm sure.
So much. But before we delve into the role that you're in today, we first wanted to hear about how you got there and the notable parts of your journey, which we know was not particularly linear.
So feel free to just bring us up to speed, and then we'll get into where you are currently.
Yeah. And I think that's a great, great sort of classification of a nonlinear journey. I never started my career thinking I wanted to be a marketer. In fact, when I went to college, I thought I wanted to be an archaeologist, quickly followed by an art historian. So a very strange sort of origin story. But long story short, after college, I chased the paycheck and went to law school and quickly found out that that wasn't the world I wanted to be in. So I ended up, you know, getting a job and bounced around between a few jobs, but ultimately ended up in a sales role at a fintech startup. And you know, the environment there was one where you smiled and dialed, you picked up the phone, you called 150 people per day, and it was a numbers game. And I didn't find that to be particularly exciting. So I tried to work smarter rather than work harder. And at this time, which is dating myself a little bit, but Yahoo Forums was a thing, it was really popular. It was sort of the first online communities that existed. And I thought, instead of dialing 100 people per day and giving them my sales pitch, let me find that community online and make one post with my sales pitch. And that's what I did. It was a foreign exchange community on Yahoo. I threw my sales pitch in there, threw my phone number and email in there. And it was amazing because within that day, week, month, I ended up closing more accounts, setting company records for accounts closed in a day, a week, a month. And it ended up with me being called into my boss's office, where I thought he was going to congratulate me and heap praise upon me. But really what he said is two things to tell you, good news and bad news. The bad news is we can't pay you commission for all of those accounts because it sounds a little shady, which in hindsight, it definitely was not shady. But the good news was they said they're going to move me to marketing because I seem to understand this thing called the internet and how you can use it from a marketing perspective. So that was sort of my foray from sales into marketing. And you know, in that specific instance, when I joined the marketing org at that company, I was really sort of on the product side of things, where I managed our educational resources. So lots of online training. It was also there where I was able to build out a really early example of a content marketing hub, do some mobile marketing and things. And from there, sort of jumped around to a bunch of different roles, led social media, which at the time was considered B2C marketing, right? Because they thought social media was free and they didn't need to invest heavily. We all know that that's changed a ton since. Through success I've built up there, ended up leading B2B marketing for a technology company, and then jumped around from companies like HSBC, which is obviously a giant financial services organization, to some smaller companies where I built out a marketing org. I think the whole company had maybe 30 people, and then ended up spending time at LinkedIn in two different stints doing some customer marketing. And now I work at a company called Isims, where I lead demand generation and customer growth. So nonlinear journey, the benefit being that I've worked at companies at different sizes, at different stages of growth, and through sort of persistence and curiosity, was able to take on responsibility across nearly every facet of marketing, which, you know, is relatively rare, I guess, for people that aren't so much of a self-starter or proactive in sort of trying to just learn as much as they could.
That's awesome. And it, I mean, we're selfishly glad that you didn't decide to become Indiana Jones, as it sounds like you're
that was my dream.
Art history and archaeologist. So, as we're kind of talking about, I mean, for just about every company, the team and the people is both the largest budget item and, you know, certainly the most valuable asset. And so can you tell us how you at Isims and how you think about that talent continuum?
Yeah, so a few things, right? And I think we'll probably get into this a little bit later when we're talking about sort of priorities for 2021. But from a priority standpoint, team and talent has always been one of my personal priorities from a marketing leadership standpoint. But with regards to the way that we think about, you know, team and talent as it relates to Isims and sort of the products and services that we deliver, you know, at Isims, we're big believers in this idea that when the right people join the right team, like amazing things happen, right? And if you think about the current landscape of, you know, where we stand and all things being equal, it's really talent that becomes your competitive advantage, right? That's going to be the one thing that's going to, you know, make company A stand out and stand apart from company B. So at Isims, our story is pretty simple. Like, we enable companies to build their winning teams through our talent cloud, which is essentially our product offering. And that allows the best companies in the world to attract, engage, hire, and advance the talent necessary to build their winning teams. So we have this like persistent theme around like winning teams and talent, which is our company story, but it's like a really authentic story that we're telling, because it just relates to so much with regards to what we do internally and what we provide for our customers externally. So, you know, long story short, and I hate to keep using that because it's sort of pun intended, right?
Fine by us.
when we think about recruiting or talent, like, we think about it with regards to something that, you know, to my friends and to my wife, I call like the talent lifecycle. And then internally and in some of our marketing materials, we'll refer to it as sort of this talent journey, right? Or a candidate journey. And it's not all about just interviewing and being hired, which is what most people think about when they think about recruiting or talent acquisition, right? Like, we really provide solutions that encircle that entire journey, including the advanced piece, which is like a piece that, you know, if you're in the talent acquisition space, like, you think about like internal mobility and upskilling and reskilling your workforce, because typically your best employees and the best talent that you need for a new role is going to be talent that you already acquired and is already doing the work within your organization. So it's an interesting story. I think at its core, it's a simple story, but it all comes down to like that piece of just, if you find the right person, you put them on the right team, I mean, the sky is really the limit. And we help facilitate and make that easy for the best companies in the world.
That's awesome. And the piece that I love that you mentioned is the internal mobility. Cause I think any of us who have been around long enough have seen plenty of times in lots of companies, big and small, they bring people into roles, but then they have a hard time envisioning that person in something different than what they brought them in for. So I think being able to enable the internal mobility that you might already have, to your point, you probably already have the right talent. Right. And it may be something different. And so, you know, somebody like your career story, right? Like, the fact that you've been able to see so many different facets of marketing, like, that is, to your point, it's not as common, but maybe it should be.
No. And I think it's a cultural mindset within organizations. Right. And I think, you know, and I'm probably butchering this. But I think I've read studies that said the average tenure of people within a company now is like 3 years, which is crazy when you think about like our parents, right?
Yeah.
That would be hired and stay someplace forever, get a pension, retire. Mm-hmm. But now I think it's something around 3 years or so. I mean, the CMO tenure, I think maybe about the same actually, or maybe a little less.
Yeah.
But with that in mind, I think, you know, successful leaders, whether it's a marketing leader or a leader in general, should always sort of have that in the back of their mind when they look at their own teams and look at the work that the people in their teams are doing and say, hey, is this something that they're still interested in doing, right? And that's a question that I typically ask the people that I manage all the time. You know, what are you excited about? Because the last thing that I want to do is have you working on something that you have zero passion for, because we know that the end result is going to be, you know, subpar work or work that just sort of is being done to get done. Right. And it's no fun for them. It's no fun for you. I mean, you really need to sort of understand where they are, what their mindset is, and what they're looking forward to growing into professionally, and providing the avenues for them to get there, hopefully within your organization. And if it's within your current team, great. If it's in a different team in your company, then you know what? You shouldn't be a roadblock for allowing them to pursue those opportunities. You should be a proponent and somebody that's sort of fostering the mentality that that's okay.
Absolutely. And so then, you know, every story needs a villain. And so in this case, just kind of curious that, you know, what are the big pain points specific to your role in marketing at Isims? You know, what are the things keeping you up at night?
Yeah, it's a great, great, great question. A lot of things keep me up at night. Luckily for me, I think I've done a good job trying to balance the whole work-life thing. So I try not to have work keep me up at night. But some of the things that I think about are, you know, again, team and talent. Are people happy? Are people, you know, what's the general gist? What's the feeling on the work that they're doing? From a marketing standpoint, you know, I do worry about, you know, are we putting the right message in front of the right person? And more so, are we providing the best possible customer experience? Because I think a lot of times people, as they're developing marketing campaigns and collateral and things, they're really doing it from their own side of the house and not necessarily thinking about the wants and needs of the customer. I mean, it's usually around, I have to deliver this many inquiries this month. I need a white paper. Here's my white paper. I'm going to go blast it on the channels that we have and do some paid advertising. And hey, we're going to get our number. But they're not necessarily thinking, does this make sense, right? Does this make sense for the mindset of the prospect? Does it make sense to the stage that person's in their buyer's journey? So it keeps me up at night just wondering if we're doing all we can to really align and focus customer first, because everyone will say that they're customer first, but the reality is most people really aren't. It takes it's really difficult to sort of strike that balance. That's really the only thing that, mm-hmm. that keeps me up at night besides my 3-month-old daughter, you know? So, like I said, I tend to try not to have things weigh on me, because I think you're always a moment away from a solution, right? So if something is really, you know, keeping you up at night, all that means is that you just need to focus more on finding an answer and building a plan to get there.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I know you said that you're customer first, but also you've mentioned the crucial point in leadership of keeping your employees happy as well. And we know you self-proclaim as a empathetic leader. And so we were just wondering, especially now when everyone is remote on your teams, you know, how do you still make sure that everyone is happy and how do you still uphold that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And actually, does it keep me up at night? No, do I think about it? Yes, right. So
okay.
I think you guys know this, but for everyone that's listening, I ended up switching companies in July. So right smack dab in the middle of the pandemic. I was working at LinkedIn, where I had been for several years and actually two different tours of duties. So in terms of my familiarity with the people, right, I was able to sort of establish and have really strong relationships with not just the people on my team, but sort of our cross-functional partners. And when I switched companies, you know, in the middle of this pandemic where everybody was working from home, you know, to sort of maintain my mission of being an empathetic leader, I mean, it's really difficult, because building that personal relationship with somebody over Zoom is not easy. And for the people that pretend that it is, I mean, they're literally pretending, right? I mean, it's so much easier to sort of develop the connection and the relationships with someone in those micro moments when you're chit-chatting about last night's episode of Real Housewives, right? Or asking someone about the big game. And these are the things that take place through happenstance and through sort of running into people, whether at the coffee machine or whatnot. Or for me specifically, one of the things that I love to do when we were actually in an office was just slide on over to somebody's, you know, desk and sit down and chat with them. Or I'm a huge proponent of brainstorming and whiteboarding. So gathering a small group of people and getting into a conference room, you know, and drawing out your ideas is awesome. There's no sort of way to do that virtually, right? So I try my best to lead all of my meetings off with just getting to know people. We do icebreakers all the time that have nothing to do with work. I mean, sometimes I try to read the room, and if I feel like, you know, people aren't looking, you know, to be very joyful, you know, sometimes we'll have team meetings where we don't talk about work at all, right? We'll do something else. I've also started, and this may be a weird thing, but I've started when I take my meeting notes for my one-on-one specifically, and I guess I'm giving away some of the secret sauce if anybody on my team is listening, but in my notes template, I have a field on mood of the meeting, right? And I actually record the mood, and thank God most of the time it's like green and everyone's happy, but there's been some moments where you can tell that the mood has been off, and I don't know what I'm going to do with that, but I feel like it's valuable information and data to have. So yeah, I mean, I think I try my best, but it's been a struggle for sure. You know, I constantly ask people how they're feeling. And then going back to the work side of things, for me, you know, I consider myself to be, if I were to say there's a fence in the middle, a marketing fence, and I ask this question in the interviews that I have, and you're standing on that marketing fence, and one side of the fence is, you know, the analytical and numbers-driven side, and the other side of the fence is the artistic and creative side. You know, what side of the fence do you fall off on, right? And I think for me personally, you know, 10 out of 10 times I'm going to fall on the artistic side. But the way that my team is structured, I have a lot of people on the team, as every team should, that would probably fall on the analytics and numbers side of things. So for me, one of my challenges, which I think is probably easier done in person than it is over Zoom, is how do I get them to flex their creative muscles, right? And empower them to start thinking creatively about what they're doing. And sort of do it in a way where if I know that their strengths and I know their interests lie on the numbers side of marketing, well, how do we pull that over into the creative side? How do we have the creative component of marketing or the story that we're telling, you know, help influence the number side? And it's, like I said, I mean, I haven't figured it out. If I figured it out, I'd probably be somewhere else, right? Making a lot more money, but it's something that's consciously on my mind because I do consider myself, you know, not just an empathetic leader, but you know, a coach, a mentor, a teacher. I mean, that's the part that in this phase of my career that I find really interesting. And I think I told you guys when we chatted in the pre-conversation, you know, if I didn't have to pay my mortgage, I would be a high school history teacher. You know, I look for people that sort of embody sort of the same characteristics in their personality. And that's really just around curiosity and perpetual learning. I think that's like key for finding, especially in marketing, people that are going to ultimately be successful.
Yeah, we're big fans. We call it intellectual curiosity around here. And the one thing I want to note is, I know you're saying that you don't totally know what you're going to do with the mood section of those one-on-one notes, but frankly, even just the fact that you're thinking about that, right? Like even just the fact that it's conscious on your mind, I think is, you know, sort of 10 steps in the right direction, right? Because I think it's like, that is the most important thing now. And so, I mean, I think you're walking the walk, whether you realize it or not. I don't know if, frankly, if there even is anything you need to do with it more than just being mindful of it at all times, much more so now than, you know, sort of prior to this, when we were all in person and it was much more task oriented and, you know, are we getting XYZ done? And, you know, sort of mood and connection and all those things were probably secondary, right? I mean, I certainly think that, at least for me, certainly that everything that we're going through right now as a society has really just helped kind of reprioritize those things in our mind. And I hope personally that always sort of stays with us going forward.
Yeah, and I think I was going to say, I think you brought up a good point there with regards to sort of expectations as well, right? I think one thing that I've learned is like you have to step your expectations down a little bit. And nobody ever wants to say that. But
right.
I mean, the reality is you do, right? There are good days and bad days. And I think, you know, one of the things which is really interesting about this period that we find ourselves in is that we have these Zoom meetings and you're getting a peek into someone's personal space and personal life, right? And, you know, some people adapt really well. I mean, I have my kids on my lap many, many times for my meetings, but I'm really comfortable with that. But there's other people that you can tell are very uncomfortable with that, right? And you can also see, you know, I've been on meetings where people are taking it from what appear to be multi-million-dollar beach homes, right? And then you're in meetings with people that are sitting in a teeny tiny, you know, bedroom because they're probably in a one-bedroom apartment in the city. So I think that sort of peek behind the curtain has done a lot to change my mindset with that idea of empathy and understanding that everybody's going through different things. And to expect, you know, perfection or expect someone to be a 9 or a 10 every day is not realistic anymore. So it's okay to be, you know, a 5 or a 6, right? And I think you need to make it known that that's okay to the people around you as well.
And that's so powerful. And that's really what it is. And I think honestly, just being mindful of it, just being okay with that and having the expectation that it's okay, right? Like, and don't be hard on yourself if we're all going through different things in different ways. And then as we spin it forward, just in terms of, you know, new year, new us. So what do you think, what are your biggest priorities from a business perspective, you know, going into 2021?
Yeah, this is great timing because I literally had a meeting this morning where, you know, I was thinking about my priorities and I was able to hear some of the priorities from our CMO. And it was a relief to hear that they lined up almost perfectly, right? So I would say number one priority is growth. So at Isims, we're extremely fortunate to be in a position where our company has just sustained this really long period of growth. And we're in an exciting time where, you know, we have goals for the future and they seem very attainable. But for that to take place, we need to grow and we need to grow aggressively. So my number one priority for myself and for the team is growth, both professionally and personally, right? I think everybody sort of has to sort of have the priorities that aren't just work related, but also sort of, you know, take place with what they're doing outside of work. So growth is my number one priority. Sort of to that end, the second priority that I think a lot about and I stress to my team a bunch as we think about our sort of marketing campaigns and our tactics and what are we going to do to drive growth is this idea of thinking big, right? And I usually say, hey, like, what are the big swings? And that's something that I literally ask everybody on the team. And I try to come up with some for myself as well. Like, what's the big swing? What's that thing that we can do where, you know, maybe 9 times out of 10, we're going to swing and miss. But if we do connect that one time, it's going to be a grand slam, right? And it's going to exponentially affect the growth. And, you know, to that end, it's like, well, what are some of the things that we can do that can be considered big swings? And I'd say most of the time, there's going to be things that we've never attempted before. So priority for the team, let's figure out what those things are and let's do them, right? And not be afraid to fail. And then the third priority for me is, and we sort of alluded to this earlier, is around team and talent, right? So it's like, you know, what can I do personally to empower my team and get them to flex those creative muscles? Because again, much like I said that at Isims, we consider sort of talent to be the competitive advantage. From a marketing standpoint, I consider creativity to be the competitive advantage. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're at a point where all of these things are essentially table stakes, right? Everybody has access mm-hmm. to Marketo. Everybody has access to Facebook for advertising. Everybody has access to a terminus or demand base from an account-based targeting standpoint. All the tools are the same. Everybody can buy the same thing. We're essentially all going after the same audience. So the only differentiation that I see is going to be what we're putting in front of those people, right? And I think the more creative you can be, the better experience you can put in front of somebody. And you know, that's going to be what's going to determine who's going to win. Because I think on the delivery component, when you think back to what I said about audience experience delivery,
yep.
I mean, everybody's essentially has access to the same audience. Everybody has access to the same delivery method. It's going to be the experience and the creativity that's going to be the differentiator. So that's a huge priority for me and my team is, you know, how do we become more creative? How do we make that sort of our competitive advantage? And it's not just the demand generation team that I lead, right? It's going to be organizationally, right? So what is the brand team doing? What is the partner team doing? What is the product team doing? What is the customer team doing? So those are probably my top priorities for 2021. That being said, the caveat will be if 2020 taught us anything, that will probably change in like 2 months, right? Let's be honest. So having that flexibility and sort of working or building frameworks that have you know, flexibility built in, I think is also pretty important.
That's great. And you know, obviously, as you said, you started Isims over the summer, sort of smack dab in the middle of the pandemic. I'm just kind of curious from a big picture perspective, how has sort of everybody working remotely across not just, you know, not just your organization, but globally, right? Like so many of us working remotely. How has that changed, you know, over the last almost year now? How has that changed potentially with the future of talent acquisition, talent management,
yeah,
of what that might look like?
So it's I think it's changed quite a bit, right? I think one, from the proponent of mindset, right? So like ISIMs, I think, right? And I wasn't there obviously before, mm-hmm, for July, but I remember through interviews and things, I think culturally they were a company where the office was a big part of their culture. So they weren't real keen on having this strong remote work culture, right? Like every other company, I mean, this pandemic comes along and I think everybody realizes pretty quickly that, hey, you can get work done, you know, being remote. So I would say that that's been one of the changes that I've seen. And from just an overall talent perspective, whether it's at ISIMS or at other companies, you know, we've found companies and data shows that these talent pools have been exponentially expanded so that now it's, I don't want to say it's easier for companies to attract, you know, that right talent. But it sort of is a little easier because now instead of just saying I need to hire an engineer that's based in the Bay Area, I can hire an engineer that's based in Nebraska, right? And I think we've all read the news and we've seen that from a technology standpoint or the tech industry, people are getting out of San Francisco. I mean, it's weird. They're all moving to Austin. So eventually Austin will become the new San Francisco, just with hotter summers. But I think that's one area where, you know, talent has really transformed in that, you know, you're no longer confined to a specific geographic area. You can really find talent anywhere. I think another thing, and this is just me based on what I've seen, so I don't have hard data on it, is I think when everybody started working from home, sort of their job descriptions expanded. People started doing much more than they had originally done. So I think that has maybe, and I'll say maybe because again, I don't know, I don't have the data, but maybe it's given a little bit of a rise to the idea of the generalist, right? And I've seen a lot of articles speaking about generalist versus specialist, and it seems as though there's a trend where people will just hire, you know, generalists because they feel as though that they can get more out of them and can sort of see the connection between the work that's being done a little bit more clear. So I think, you know, being remote has shown that to be something as well, where in a pinch you need something done. In an office, it's easy to walk over to somebody and ask them to do it. When everybody's on Zoom, it's sort of, hey, this needs to be done. And you know, I've seen that during my time at LinkedIn, where there was a lot of work that needed to be done. Companies weren't necessarily hiring at that particular time. So what they were doing were posting all of the stuff that needs to be done. I guess you can say sort of like a honey-do list, right? Like, honey, please do this. And it was just sort of on like a TaskRabbit type infrastructure where whoever had the bandwidth, and it was a lot of times recruiters, would just go in and grab a task and work on it, even if it had nothing to do with recruiting per se. That's a really interesting concept that I've heard a lot of companies that I won't name, but have shifted to that model, right? Where it's sort of went from, you know, these traditional team-based structures and have sort of evolved into project-based teams that are sort of constantly evolving based on the project. So I think it's a pretty interesting concept. We haven't necessarily switched to that model at ISIMS, but it's something that I'll be paying attention to see how it works at other companies, because I think going back to, hey, after 2 or 3 years, I'm bored of my current job because I was hired to do one thing and I've done that for 2 years.
Yep.
If you move to this model where it's like, here's the project, we're going to build a team around the project. You're going to have this responsibility. Once that project's done, that team disbands, right? And then we're going to build another new team to take on another project. I mean, it's almost, I guess, maybe similar to what happens in consulting. I've never been a consultant, but it'd be really interesting to see how that evolves and if more companies sort of adopt that.
I can certainly speak to that. I mean, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time in consulting, and that was always something that appealed to me, was the idea that there's, you know, no matter what it is, the people, the projects, the clients, like they're just constantly changing. And so I think you're right. I think it really is that. And I know myself personally, when I've felt a little more, you know, kind of just like not moving fast enough, it was when I was in those situations where it just felt like I had done this, you know, it just felt like a repeat of the same movie I had seen the year before and the year before that. And that I think is, so to your point, I think it's interesting. And I think you have a great perspective at Isims, because you're helping to build the software that companies are going to use to do this, you actually kind of get a bird's eye view of how effectively it's working. And hopefully, again, is it sounds like you guys do pretty well as then internalizing any of that stuff that you're seeing work well out, you know, out with your customers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's nice, you know, at Isims, even at LinkedIn, I mean, you really have a pulse on mm-hmm. on the market, right? And in this case, you know, talent, for example. And, you know, I'd never been interested in talent or recruiting before going to LinkedIn the second time, because the right. first time I went to LinkedIn, I was on the marketing side of things, in terms of marketing solutions. And it's really fascinating space because, again, you know, going back to the story, it truly is talent that is the competitive advantage. And if you think about who's the most powerful person in a company, you know, yes, the CEO is powerful, but the recruiters that are putting the people in the seats are almost as powerful because they mm-hmm. are essentially setting the course for that company's success.
So we know you refer to yourself as a T-shaped marketing leader. And so we're just wondering in terms of, we know you mentioned some of the initiatives that you hope to take on in the future, but can you just explain a little bit more what that means to you and then how that also impacts how you go about your various marketing initiatives?
Yeah, it's funny. So I use T-shaped just because that's like a real thing, right? and it's pretty popular. Reality, I would probably be just like a multiple W, right? Like sort of like going deep on a lot of things. But conventional wisdom says that you can't be that person that knows a lot about everything, which I think is false. And I would argue that. But yeah, I mean, I think so. A few things around sort of the depth and the breadth of my interests, my experience, what I consider myself to be decent at, is it all goes back to the idea of just being like eternally curious, right? So sort of getting from point A to point B in my marketing career, you know, or where I am now, was really just because I personally found specific parts of marketing really interesting. And I'm the type of person and have the personality where I'll go do it at work if I can. So like, for example, you know, when I was at Glia, you know, we wanted to just create a podcast. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I've never done it before, right? But I have sort of this infatuation with fact gathering, and I went down the rabbit hole deep for, you know, a week or so, and to learn everything about podcasting. And we went ahead and launched a podcast that was, you know, relatively successful. You know, with regards to things like SEO, where I haven't really done it professionally within an organization, I've still had the interest to learn about it. So then, what do? I launch a personal blog, right? And I practice SEO on blog articles that I post to sort of build that knowledge, right? So it's, you have to be proactive in doing it. From a design standpoint, you know, when I think about marketing is, you know, it's words and pictures, right? If you want to pretend you're Don Draper, right? So I did a lot of writing through college and through law school, and I enjoy writing. I love design, but when I think back to the early part of my career, I mean, sure, I can draw things and whatnot, but I wasn't great at graphic design in a traditional sense. So what did I do there? I didn't necessarily have the opportunity early in my career to like create banner ads, for example, or design websites, but I did have access to resources, namely a designer, right? So I took advantage of that and sat next to them pretty much for years and asked a million questions. I mean, I am a persistent, probably annoying person in the amount of questions that I'll ask, but that's how I learned. So there, you know, I was able to gather enough design chops to do graphic design outside of work, right? As a hobby for some side money. But also now when we're designing a campaign, I could be very prescriptive with what I want, right? And I tell people, I know what I want. It doesn't always mean that I'm right, right? But I'll always tell you what I'm thinking in hopes that you tell me I'm wrong, if that makes any sense. That was a really strange sentence. But I mean, I think that all comes from that idea of being quote unquote T-shaped, but really more so just really being W-shaped, which I think maybe I just coined for the first time, but it's...
we'll take it.
Yeah, I think...
You heard it here first.
Yeah, I just think it's critically important. You know, even as I moved up in my career to become a manager per se, I still think it's critically important to understand how the work gets done, especially if you're going to ask somebody to do the work, right? Because I'm sure we've all been in instances where you have a manager that that tells you to do something and you know that they have no concept of what's actually involved in doing it. And it can be very frustrating, right? So again, that idea of being an empathetic leader, I just want to know what's required of the people that I'm asking them to do things so that I'm not asking them for something that's unreasonable.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I'm sure your employees appreciate that too. So shifting gears a bit, we've talked about where you've been and what you hope to do career-wise, but we're curious about what success means to you. This can be in a personal or professional sense, but we love asking this because it means something different to every person.
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? And I think it would be really something if you were to ask that question to someone every 3 years, right, throughout their career, because it would be completely different. And it's funny. So I'm going to answer your question, probably not in the way that you asked it. So as I'm older now, and I'm older than I look, if that's what I've been told. But when I think back to my younger self, and you know, I realized that I never sort of thought about what success looked like when I was younger. And I don't know if that was the right mindset, the wrong mindset. But what it didn't do is it didn't necessarily give me the linear journey that some people have, where they know out of college, I want to be a managing director, right, at Goldman Sachs by age 30. And then it's there you go, right? So for me, I never really sort of knew what I wanted. As I got a little older, you know, you start thinking about success, but it changes. Like, I think probably my first sort of thought was like, oh, I want to make more money, right? And I think monetarily, like a lot of people equate that to success. And then once you get to a certain level of financial comfort, right, success becomes something a little bit different for some people. I mean, some people it's continued, right? Some people want that Ferrari. I mean, I would love a Ferrari, but I'm not gonna wake, you know, stay awake for hours on end trying to get there. But for now, I mean, what does success look like for now? I think it's really heavily around family for me. I think back to my first stint at LinkedIn, and we had a leader there named Mike Gamson, who was in charge of the sales organization at that time. And I remember he was in the office and somebody had asked him what his personal belief on work-life balance was, which I thought it's a great question, right? And he says, I don't believe in work-life balance, which took everybody, you know, aback. What do you mean? He goes, well, for there to be work-life balance, that means that work and life are equal, right? And he's like, and that's not necessarily true. For me, work will never be as important than my family and life, right? And that stuck with me, because that's like, the older you get, the more that makes sense. So for me, success is like just, you know, being able to sustain some type of happiness at home and allow my kids to sort of, you know, have what they need, not necessarily more than they need. But then I think professionally, I think success to me, it boils down to, I think respect is important, right? And like people genuinely, you know, respecting your opinion and people enjoying working with you because you're spending so much time with these people. And then, you know, at some point it would be great to be in a position, like I strive to be a CMO one day, just because I love to sort of bet on myself. And I think it's interesting when you're at the top of the pyramid, right? Where your decisions are ultimately sort of deciding whether you win or lose. You get that feedback pretty quickly. But yeah, I mean, with regards to success, I mean, probably more on the family side. From the professional side, the things that I explained, that was like a really deep answer to what was probably a simple question, huh?
No, I think the whole point is that everyone takes that in your own way. And I think generally we have this idea as a society of what success should be. But the fascinating part is that each individual realistically defines that personally and professionally slightly different, which is why I think it is such a great question.
Yeah. I mean, all that being said, my wife and I recently finished watching the show on HBO Max called Industry. And watching these young bankers, I think back, and my wife always jokes with me. She's like, I should have married a finance guy, because it sure would be nice to be a millionaire by age 25, right? Which is, I think, what one of the characters on the show said. But yeah, maybe in the next life.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like, but then what are you going to do to enjoy it, right? And like, and that's where, to your point, I'm sort of on the same line as you are, and I really like the fact that you said the 3-year timeline, because that's actually. We kind of, the way we talk to our guests sometimes we literally ask the question about okay, if we look back 3 years from now, what will you say success has been? So it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that. And I've always said the same thing for myself is that, you know, the best advice I can ever give is you want to have a definition of success, but one that's not too far in the future or too, you know, sort of like set in stone, right? Like that you want it to be malleable. Cause to your point, you know, look, you might want to plan for 6 months, a year, 2 years from now, but anything beyond that is kind of a fool's errand, right? And saying like, it must 100%. Be these three things. Like, you know, you're probably going to end up closing yourself off to opportunities that, you know, things may have changed, what your definition of success may have changed. And just, again, back to the flexibility aspect.
Yeah. And life comes at you hard, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, I know like we're talking about marketing for the most part, but, you know, it's very likely that tomorrow I may want to become a congressman, right?
That's it.
Especially
That's
after it. The events of the last few days. So I think that idea that you just mentioned, you know, sort of thinking about things in sort of smaller time mm-hmm. horizons, it just lends you to not fail, not feel as though you're failing,
right?
Because your goals and your measure of success change, right? Yep. Which is very normal for people.
Yep, completely. So before we let you go, we had a couple things. So first, what resources, books, podcasts, anything like that would you want to share with our audience?
Yeah. So I've gotten back on the reading train, which is great. So I typically do all of my reading on my Kindle and then sync all of my notes. So I take lots of highlights, lots. Mm-hmm. I sync them to an app called Notion. So that I have them stored. But in terms of what I've been reading, I tend to try to go back and forth between like a marketing or business book. So right now, I actually started a book club with my team at work. So we're reading a book called Positioning by I think the author is Al Ries, and there's one other author. But it's just about, you know, building a narrative, right, and positioning products and things. So we're reading it collectively as a group. We're going to discuss it at the end of the month. So that means that the next book I read will be nonfiction. Will be fiction. Right. The next book I read will be fiction. I have a hard time finding fiction books just because I'm not in that literati circle. So I don't know. In terms of other resources, I'm big on podcasts. I love Pivot with you know, Scott Galloway and Kara Swisher. I just mm-hmm. think it's really, really interesting. That's probably my favorite. And then I've recently just fell back in love with Twitter. There's a pretty thriving marketing Twitter community. So if you actually like hashtag marketing Twitter and post something there, there's a pretty awesome collection of people that are highly engaged. You know, so much so that I've attempted to create an off Twitter platform or community on an app called Circle for marketers to really just freely share in conversation and resources and things. And it's going fairly well. We have like 70 or so members of that community so far. It's been like a week. So we're going to try to grow that and see, because I think it's just great to have other people to bounce ideas off of in an environment where you feel safe. With regards to any other resources, I mean, I still love reading Fast Company magazine. I feel like people don't read magazines anymore, right. But I'm a big fan. And then I've also, you know, going back to the tail end of last year, I've become a huge fan of the New York Times, so much so that I pay for a subscription. I try to read it every day on my iPad. It's just great, I think, to go back to reading newspapers, right? And sort of seeing the interesting stories there instead of just relying on whatever comes across your newsfeed and some social media channel. So those are pretty much what I interact with and read. And I watch a ton of YouTube. My wife makes fun of me. I don't think she gets it. Like, I think she thinks YouTube is just funny videos, but
right,
there's so many awesome things on YouTube and so many things you can learn, whether it's marketing or guitar. I mean, those are probably two of the three categories I watch most. I watch a ton on photography as well, which is a hobby of mine. So.
That's great. And then speaking of social media, where can people find you?
Yeah, I mean, the best place would be on Twitter. I'm at Jeffrey Mack. So at @JeffreyMack. And you can attempt to connect with me on LinkedIn. However, I've been doing an audit. So going back to last quarter, I've been accepting everybody that has requested me on LinkedIn, just so I can see how long it would take for a sales pitch to come in my inbox. And I think right now I stopped keeping track like a week ago, but I think the average time frame for a sales pitch was about 6 hours, which is crazy. At the very least, pretend that you want to connect with me because you're interested in me and not what I can do for you. But it's I feel like it's gotten a little crazy. So you can attempt to connect with me on LinkedIn. Just don't try to sell me anything.
Well, that's great. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on. This was awesome. We'd love to have you back, in a couple months, and hopefully we can get updates on how everything's going. But thanks for being on, and thanks for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was awesome chatting on this glorious afternoon. And definitely very keen to jump on. We can talk about something else in the future. I'm a man of many facets, so we can find something else.
I think we've already uncovered a few of those. So.
We'll ask you what your definition of success is in 3 years. So.
That's right. That's
touch
right.
back yeah, then, so if
let's,
nothing
let's
else.
Let's go. Hopefully by then I'll be let's shoot for more than a congressman. I'll be a senator at that point.
Perfect. Well, thanks for being on, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that was a great conversation with Jeff. Always a great reminder that people are the most important part of any organization. And now it's time for Footnotes with Sophia.
Footnotes is where we expand on portions of the discussion that we wanted to learn more about and share with you. So to start things off, Jeff has really worked to develop his leadership style and focused a lot on it in this episode. Now more than ever, leaders are under such pressure to succeed on behalf of themselves, their teams, their companies, etc. And I read this really fascinating McKinsey article that seems right up Jeff's alley in that they argue the best way for a leader to succeed right now is to prioritize job satisfaction. So what's interesting is that employee satisfaction is really essential to good business, which I will get into in a moment, but specifically relationships with supervisors play a huge role. In fact, the number one role in employees' job satisfaction. Additionally, not only is employee satisfaction internally beneficial, but there are empirical links between employee satisfaction, customer loyalty, and profitability.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And probably when I think about it, not that surprising. I've certainly heard over the years that your employee with your direct supervisor is the most impactful of the relationships you'll have. And it makes a ton of sense because especially in any medium or bigger size organization, frankly, your direct boss is sort of responsible for giving you context, helping you see the forest through the trees, helping you understand kind of the purpose for a lot of the things you're doing. And certainly if you're, and then obviously there's all of the different personal components that then go into that as well. And so it's one of those things where I kind of get the impression that your relationship with your supervisor can either kind of grease the skids and lead to sort of a very positive influence, or I can see, and certainly at least anecdotally, a lot of people I've talked to over the years, that if there's a negative experience, a lot of times the most frequent thing that they'll mention is their relationship with their supervisor.
Yeah, I also think it's really interesting that a lot of the leaders we've focused on and spoken to thus far with our podcast talk about how they're making emotion at the forefront of their leadership approach, because realistically in this, it just says employee satisfaction. And so their route to establishing that satisfaction and relationship with their employees is through a more emotion-based relationship. But it's interesting that that's how a lot of them are taking this on.
Yeah. And certainly obviously the time we're living in, I imagine, is going to play a big part in that. But even just in general, and something I personally did throughout my career was, sort of remembering, what it was like on sort of the other side of the table, so to speak, right? And so learning from different situations and different things that I did or particularly didn't like, frankly, of managers I've had over the years. And I tried very hard to kind of crystallize those and say that, when I'm in the position on the other side, that I try to do my best to make sure that those things are not felt, because I remember very clearly what it felt like to be in that seat and to feel unimportant or to feel, there are times, and this is inevitable, but where you're spending all of your time and focus on a particular project only to find out kind of at the end of it that it's been deprioritized or something like that. Mm-hmm. And just sort of that hollow feeling, that level of unimportance of, well, what does it really matter what I'm doing? And it's so impactful. So I imagine that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. And, it's interesting what you said too, in that prioritizing projects and clear explanations, those aren't inherently emotional tasks, but they still impact your emotional relationship with your manager. And so I think that's interesting for people who might not necessarily be inclined to lead with emotion, in that things that aren't explicitly tied to emotion still create emotional experiences.
Yeah, and I certainly think that as a manager and as a leader, I always say my goal is to sort of clear the path, right, for everybody. And I want to remove any of those roadblocks, especially. And so, you know, frankly, oftentimes the best relationships with your managers are probably ones that you don't even recognize, right? Because it's really just that there's no friction. So it's more of the absence of negative, more so. But yeah, totally makes sense. And so certainly even somebody who is very, let's say, emotionally aware, doesn't necessarily mean that if they're not thoughtful about clearing those roadblocks and sort of helping put their team in a position to succeed, that it's still not necessarily going to meet that, you know, sort of like not going to hit on all cylinders.
Yeah, definitely.
Another thing Jeff mentioned is the way that he's working to take his analytic heavy team and lead them and enable them to flex their creative muscles as well. And so I think this is a really interesting problem that a lot of leaders are experiencing. But what I find fascinating is that although analytics and creative thinking are typically viewed as opposing forms of thought, you can actually use the two and strategically fuel both ends. So for example, analytics on prior campaigns can help figure out then what worked on the creative side and use information to draw and fuel new strategy. While I understand Jeff is working to push his team on the creative ideas component, I also think restructuring our mindset about putting analytics and creative thinking on opposite sides and instead view them as harmonious unit might enable leaders to better merge the two and inspire their teams.
It's a great point. I think so many people almost align themselves with one or the other, right? They're sort of like warring factions. And I think you're right. And you know, for me personally, like through my own career, I saw myself purely on the analytic side and you know, just never felt that I was very creative at all. I none of the artistic talents, it was all from my mom's side of the family. I didn't get those genes as strongly. And you know, it was just, I was always very data driven and very logical, and therefore I can't be creative. And then it wasn't until, you know, at some point, you know, years ago, where I realized, like, you know what, like the way you can actually measure something or the way you can actually test something, there needs to be some real creativity there. And especially, you know, frankly, for some of these more difficult, you know, B2B clients that we work with and the longer sales cycles and the more complexity that's there, frankly, the more creative you have to be around how can you do that. And so it was one of those things that I didn't even recognize that in myself. And then at the same time, I mean, you know, certainly you're speaking to the right audience around the fact that, you know, really, we as a company believe very much around how it's about all about the marriage between data and storytelling, and that neither of them on their own can really be as powerful as when you bring them together.
And I think that's really the point that we make with a lot of different discussions, is that anything that is typically viewed as in its like own little realms or silos, when you bring them together and look at it as one entire component, is when you're going to reap the most benefits from each of those individual components that you would otherwise keep separate.
Yeah. So again, you know, story after my heart for sure.
Story backed by data after your heart.
Yep. Thank you, Sophia. As always, all of the research and references can be found in the show notes. If you want to reach out to us directly about this story or to inquire about sharing your own story, you can reach us at lsspodcast@circanresearch.com. And thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us for a new story next week on Long Story Short. I want to thank Circan Research for being the sponsor of our show. Circan Research fuels demand for B2B marketers looking to gain a competitive advantage. We leverage original research and data-driven content to supercharge your growth. You can find out more on our website at circanresearch.com.